Chapter 6. Hope Becomes Trucidation.
Should we eat first or go to the pawn shop first?
I'll let you decide, Candy. Shen and I can go for a while without food, so it doesn't matter.
He was keeping the actual primary reason from her.
Pawn shop it is. Both the restaurant that Xaxa mentioned and the shop are close enough anyways.
They walked about the street, Shinaga taking note of the heat reverberating off the sun-baked asphalt of the paved street.
Chief, I may need to know this sooner than later.
The heat from the street made Retho worry about the condition of his highly worn tires. It was just an eventuality before they burst.
Yeah, Gorik?
How much combat experience do you have? I trust your judgment, but I can't say for sure how or what kind of fight we might run into.
You mean a fight with men?
Their route was nearing Kasumi and Blound.
Doesn't it amaze you that there's this whole world always existing as a part of the one everyone lives in, and yet it's a secret to the average person?
Switching to one hand on the wheel.
It really makes you wonder, just what exactly else are we missing when we look at the world?
He turned towards Gorik. Gorik understood that although Chief Retho was not a Nen user, he would be one to rely on in any kind of potentially lethal encounter. Living as long as he has in an occupation such as his meant you'd have to have picked up something in a place like this. The chief placed both hands on the wheel as he made the final turn. They parked behind Blound's squad car. Kasumi and Blound were waiting for them to exit the car and experience the scent as well. Gorik and the chief got out and went to meet them. Kasumi led the encounter, wasting no time.
If anything, it could be a trap. The reason things are so easy, I mean. The building is locked and the window is painted. Someone is hiding something in there, and there's the other thing.
This smell has to be something. Kasumi and I can't quite place it, but we know we've smelled it before.
Chief took Blown's description of the smell, its familiar qualities in particular, and began running through his mind as he crossed the road. The rest followed him. The smell came back, and Kasumi had barely been able to prepare her nostrils for the re-entry of the scent. Blound had forgotten to plug his nose, as Kasumi was doing, and was caught off guard again. The chief's face might have given a clue, though he was in front.
Yes, I've smelled this before.
I know exactly what this smell is.
Gorik was quite familiar with it due to his travels. Gorik was ready to draw and moved up to where the chief was preparing to test the door. Kasumi and Blound went for the window just in case of an emergency breaching. When the chief confirmed the locked status of the door, Gorik got ready to kick it in, which prompted Kasumi to join Gorik and Retho in breaching the front.
Hello?
A man came up to the front.
Yes, oh!
He was startled to see someone in the shop, as if they had broken in.
Is this the pawn shop?
Little lady, I think it's the only one in town. Now, what can I get you?
The man noticed Whisk standing with Shinaga near the door.
That dog's gotta stay outside, you get me?
The voice was almost muffled by the smell of his breath.
We'll be right out here, Candy.
Don't leave without me, okay?
She was worried he might give up and leave Cimeterium without her.
Don't worry, we've got nowhere else to go anyways.
Whisk took Shinaga outside to wait for Candy to finish up inside.
Why do you care if there's a dog in here? You keep it messier than any dog would make it.
Lady, I don't need to take this shit.
Realizing she needed to pander.
Sorry now. I hear you are someone with a certain special talent for keeping and sharing something. I was just needing...
Yeah. Pay first. You pay to make this something other than a pawn shop, and then I determine how much it costed to answer whatever question you had, okay?
Fine.
She handed over some money. The man at the counter in the poorly lit pawn shop began counting the money. She didn't wait for him to be done.
Rafa G.
What about him?
Where was he heading?
You meaning life, baby. We're all heading to one destination.
I mean, where was he heading to? A location?
Well, he wouldn't tell me why they were here.
Was the group with him?
He came in here with two or three others. Some more were waiting outside. I bet he had people at other places too, though.
What did they want?
The answer to that question's the same as the answer to your first question, actually.
He scratched at his face.
They were looking for a place to stay. Off the books sort of thing.
So,
that one's gonna cost double.
I don't even know how much I'm paying you for these questions.
He wrote something down and slid it over to her.
You've got to be kidding me!
Look, miss, that much will get you the answer to the question, pay for your previous questions, And I'll even throw in another question, no extra charge. Because I'm nice.
Candy reluctantly handed over the amount asked for.
So, they were looking for a place to stay.
Gorik kicked the door in with Chief and Kasumi entering behind him. Blound later followed. The ceiling had a hole in it, letting out the stench while partially illuminating the interior. The scene was a grotesque menagerie of body parts strewn about haphazardly. Most of the bodies were only fractions of what could be considered a full human. In several places, it was tough to tell where one corpse ended and another began. The blood was scattered across all surfaces in the room, dripping down the walls and ceiling to puddles on the floor. Most of it was dried. The room looked reminiscent of a Fidori Poplandi piece. A master artist, his early career consisted of abstract paintings expressing vague thoughts and impressions. Broad, smudged brushstrokes permeated and blended with precise, pointillist textures, evoking a contrast of shape. His work was beginning to gain popularity in some circles when he began experimenting with sculpture. The combination of sculpture and painting was his quest. "I seek a new canvas, one with as much life as the paint I place," he famously said. The works were different approaches to melding the two mediums. Most of his work in this time was harshly panned. Only a few saw the latent potential being expressed with each new piece. He died before being recognized for his most famous work. His last creation was an untitled piece, seen as his magnum opus, but it wasn't exposed to vast populations until after his death. Critics point out that it may have been his death itself which propelled the piece to fame, and thus meant he was no more than a fraud in their eyes. However, when viewing the work with Gio-enhanced eyes, the amount of aura ingrained into the work was said to be blinding. Indeed, this discovered scene was eerily similar in composition to Fidori's final piece, as the installation was often referred. It was so transfixing that one might take extra care when choosing the lens with which to photograph the crime scene, paying attention more to framing than to delivering information. It would be tough to discern anything as to the breakdown of events, but interestingly enough, the carnage was composed in such a manner that the flow of the limbs and fragmented people in the room seemed to converge on a convolution of brain matter and ground-up organs just off-center of the room. One possible explanation is that a few of the bodies were destroyed simultaneously, even if some were already dead. It could be that the perpetrator was intentionally destroying the bodies, or it could be that the corpses were dragged into the struggle between the living and damaged further. Either way, the attacks were very destructive and could even be considered disrespectful of their targets.
"It wasn't paint on the windows then,"
Kasumi muttered. Peering around,
"Looks like 7, maybe 8 or 9 people."
Gorik was almost shocked at what he was saying. Blound moved about, trying not to touch anything. He felt the need to sit or lean against the wall, but he didn't dare touch the floor any more than his shoes needed to. The wall was a similar story. The chief turned around and walked back out of the structure. This image would be a part of his remaining life. It would be a permanent memory. Everything, from the ray of light through the ceiling to the damaged and cracked walls, this was a part of who he was now. Even with Gorik's vast experience, a sight like this stood out. This wasn't just a body in a room. This was an environment of carnage. The very scenery itself was made out of the remains of what was once life. All of this would be evoked by that horrid smell, just as previous horrors were evoked from it beforehand for him. From what was originally a task that seemed too small for the big profile help the CPD had accumulated, was now a glimpse into a matter that seemed to eclipse them all. It was as if a monolith had interrupted the connection between the ground they stood on and the sun. With these first steps into this almost foreign land they discovered, they stepped into the shadows of a new worldview consuming them. Cimeterium was new again.
"What question is that?"
Virgil was talking to someone new to him, Dread Law. A fight was not optimal. Both Virgil and Anya had used up much of their energy and Nen on their fight, and hadn't had a chance to replenish over the night by staying up to keep control of Lamino, in case he wander off and get the attention of the police while they were in their diminished states. Law spoke up, not wanting to waste time.
"First, let the officer go."
This request was not the best thing to hear for Virgil, as they'd worked hard to keep him in their control over the night. Either way, keeping him till now was good for maintaining some form of cover from the chaos that ensued during their fight. He could be a useful asset, and at the least, couldn't cause any more trouble. It wasn't a complete loss to give up the control that was kept throughout the night. Regardless of the value he had, the time and Nen used were sunk costs, and Virgil understood it wasn't worth factoring in. For Anya, however, this request was favorable. She didn't want the liabilities associated with Lamino now. It would be best if they distanced themselves from him, she figured. However, she understood the potential negatives that would happen once they relinquished control. It was hard to determine for her how to react to Virgil's motives of chaos, given this new situation. Anya nodded to Virgil, showing she was okay with it, so Virgil responded,
All right, but we do it our way.
Fine.
The other man with law was slightly behind him, not speaking.
We'll get rid of him once you tell us the question.
Anya was discovering an interest in law now, for he had to have seen their fight.
I want you to join me.
How'd it go, Candy?
Got what I needed.
Can we eat now? I'm getting hungry.
Sure thing. Sorry you and Shen had to wait outside. I don't like that guy.
Shen doesn't like him either. You two seem to have a lot in common, actually.
She thought about that. Perhaps Whisk was able to see something she hadn't realized through introspection. He knew Shen far better than she, and could possibly have picked up on something from her that she didn't realize. It was tough for her to tell what he was referring to, though. They walked to the restaurant around the corner that they had passed before. They went to enter it, but were stopped.
Excuse me, but that dog must wait outside.
Whisk sighed.
Twice in one day, Shen.
Can't we eat outside?
Candy really wanted to have Shen included, if not for her wishes, for Whisk's.
I'm sorry, but no.
Whisk could see that Candy was trying to be inclusive. He devised his own plan.
Candy, I got this. Just get a table and I'll meet you inside.
You sure?
Yeah, I just need to talk to Shen for a second.
Okay, I'm so sorry this happened again.
Don't worry about it.
He smiled. She was thinking back on her brief collection of memories with him. Had he smiled before? If he did, she can't remember seeing it. Or maybe she did. But something about this one made her take notice. When she'd hear the name Whisk, she'd see this image from now on.
I'll see you in a moment.
She said to the two before walking in. Inside, she was able to get a table for two and was sat near a wall with several empty tables in between hers and ones with any other people seated. Several tables over were two girls around the same age as Candy.
He says he'll meet us here.
Did he say how long it would take?
Lahara replayed the conversation with Alexander on the phone in her head.
No, he didn't. This town's pretty small, though.
I guess so.
To Dahlia, it was massive, but she knew how quickly it could be traversed.
I hope he finished the dresses.
Dahlia smelled something. It wasn't food, something very familiar to her. She caught the scent of an animal, but there was none in the building. Whisk was walking through to find the table Candy got. He felt out of place, but still found it and took the seat. Candy had a menu open and slid one over to him. As he picked it up,
Where's Shen?
He smirked.
Now don't tell anyone.
She followed his arm down. He hadn't been moving it from where it was, as if attached to something. The sensation of being licked appeared on her leg. She flinched.
I can only do this while touching him, so I'm going to need to leave my arm down like this.
Candy understood and unfolded his menu for him. Then she began to smirk as well.
You enjoying yourself?
Absolutely.
Cern was, of course, talking to Zero. Zero was surprised to be having this much fun. It might have been the lack of consequence, or it might have been how he was being pushed. Cern asked the question because it was eminently obvious that he was enjoying their bout. At this time, both Maxwell and Alexander had left. Neither fighter had noticed. A change in strategy was needed from Zero. The random chance had given him an armor that turned out to be the opposite of what he needed. Too much of the armor's time had been used up already, but waiting it out could mean another handful of slashes connecting from Cern's conjured weapons. This was a fight decided by speed. Zero knew that there was one real option available to him to supplant the difference in ability between the two. He deactivated his devil armor and remembered his mission. Defeat Cern. It wouldn't matter, as the mission's nature would mean neither armor would be favored, as he realized before. Zero conjured the coin. This prompted Cern to rush in to stop him. All Zero had to do was to flip it. so before Cern got there, he flipped it at an angel in one direction and ran the other. With this action, Cern had to choose which to go after, so he chose Zero. If the coin turned out to be a weapon, Cern didn't want to fall for a trap. Without armor, Zero was open for much more potent slashes. The most logical choice was to go for Zero before anything happened to try and land a hit, but when the coin landed, it displayed the number on it, and Zero began to transform before Cern could reach him. Neither one saw the number, so Zero did not know how long this armor would last.
It would be no matter,
Zero thought to himself as the armor manifested around him while in motion. Cern stabbed at Zero with a blade, but Zero was able to move out of the way at a much higher speed than Cern was moving. The armor that had been conjured was golden and less menacing in design. This was the angel armor. With it, Zero's speed was now higher than Cern's, and the battle would become a different animal in Zero's eyes. With less strength again, it would be a matter of limiting Cern's movements and striking many hits over time to wear him down. At this time, Zero felt something strange. What it was, he wasn't sure of yet. Cern, meanwhile, was keeping his eye open for the openings in the armor, which would allow him to speed up the effects of the poison with subsequent hits. His reflexes would be Cern's best defense. Zero began moving erratically. With angular turns and many feints, he was trying to bait Cern into overextending. Cern would need to remain prepared for a strike in order to prevent damage. As the two danced, the time had come. Time was on Cern's side for several reasons. The first was the poison. If he held out long enough, he wouldn't need to land another attack before Zero would be incapacitated. The other was the armor's time limit. With Zero not knowing how much time he had in the angel armor, he'd be forced to make the first move if Cern was on the defensive. If he waited too long, he could time out of the armor and be stuck with neither devil nor angel armor for too long, as Cern's superior physical abilities would make the fight a one-sided affair. Before Zero could bait Cern into a counterattack, he unleashed a staccato of light punches on him from several angles. Cern was able to keep up and block most of the attacks, preventing any noticeable damage. However, he had taken several hits, a few at the same spot. The method Zero was going for was to bruise and lightly damage areas repeatedly until the pain racked up. Each consecutive hit at the same spot would cause more pain and lead to harsher bruising, even leading to broken bones. But because of Cern's reflexes, Zero could not hit key targets to impact his mobility and attacking ability. Instead, he was forced to attack his openings where Cern was willing to be hit, as he had to choose which attacks to block. While Zero's strategy could still work this way, it would take much longer. Another approach might be more beneficial to him in this situation. Zero attempted to use his speed to cover ground in wide arcs, coming back with full body attacks, which would force Cern to dodge. He was able to dodge them several times, but these attacks were not the focus. Cern knew what Zero was doing, but there'd be little he could do if it could be pulled off correctly. While Cern was in his dodging motion, Zero corrected his path and attacked Cern, who was in an awkward position. Cern knew this would happen, but his plan was simple. Instead of countering, he'd make this a battle of attrition. Due to Zero's weak hits and Cern's poison, if they traded hits every time, it would wind up more beneficial to Cern. This also plays well with the battle of time the two were undergoing. So, while Cern couldn't block nearly as many of Zero's flurry this time, he was able to make Zero commit to the movement and slashed at an opening. The hit was shallow, but poison would definitely enter from the wound. It wasn't much longer that Zero flew up in the air after feeling the effects of the poison start to take hold. In the air, using his flying ability, he'd be safe from any of Cern's attacks. But this was not the objective. Being safe in the air was a temporary solution, as time would run out for him eventually. Limit mobility. That was his battle plan. With that in mind, he swooped down. Cern wasn't sure if he was meaning to add verticality to his previous strategy, as that wouldn't change Cern's counter. But then Zero struck. He feinted his attack, causing Cern to dodge like before, but this time he replaced the flurry of punches with another full-body attack. With his speed and flight, he caught Cern off guard with a tackle that no reflexes could prevent. With this tackle, he launched Cern up into the air. From that height, Zero knew Cern would be able to land okay. If he wanted, he could launch him up higher with another hit, but that could mean potentially fatal results. He didn't want to kill, merely defeat. With Cern mid-air, he wouldn't be able to dodge and would have to rely on blocking. As Cern began to fall, Zero made passing attacks at him with single strikes, sometimes sending Cern flying to the side. When he got closer to the ground, Zero hit him back upwards again and maintained his juggle. Cern was forced to block each attack as it came. He made a few slashes, but they didn't connect. Without the ground to reposition his body, Zero had the advantage with his flight ability. It was only slight, but his speed was dropping due to the poison, however. The fight would need to end soon. Cern exerted Nen from his feet as Zero made another pass. They both knew that to prevent Zero from attacking would mean that his last strategy would fail. The poison had slowed Zero enough for Cern to catch him as he passed by, propelling himself towards him with Nen, mid-air. Cern grabbed Zero's leg and climbed his way onto his back. The two were wrestling mid-air until Cern wrapped him with the blades in hand. It was a dangerous move, but it meant that if either one moved too much, he could accidentally slice into himself or Zero. If he wanted to, he could hold a blade up to Zero's throat with this stalemate. However, death is not the goal. As this unfolded, Zero grabbed Cern's arms and took a nosedive into the ground. He would mean to force a tie. With a cloud of dust and dirt in the air, Cern walked back out. Zero had been too weakened by the poison to fully protect his body for the impact. He was conscious, but depleted. Cern was not completely unscathed. Bruised and bleeding from a wound sustained in the crash, he had a look of pure satisfaction on him.
"Looks like we lost our audience,"
Zero replied while slowly getting up.
"Think they got bored."
"Who cares?"
Zero deactivated the angel armor to save his remaining Nen.
"You don't really know someone until you've fought them.
Want a drink? That bar we were just at is pretty decent. Maybe your buddy is back there right now."
Cern was referring to Maxwell, who had disappeared. Maxwell had made his way to the northernmost village bordering Cimeterium, the Ridge Floor Village. Once a high-quality living area, it attracted all kinds of wealthy business owners on the island to purchase properties there and take in the various sites, including the mountains just near them. As living areas in the city became more luxurious due to a business specializing in high-cost living starting up in Cimeterium, the village was abandoned, and with a lack of maintenance, the market there plummeted. Now it is for the lowest income groups on the island. Most people try to live in the villages between the docks and the city, so Ridgefloor has suffered being out of mind due to being out of sight. The mayor was elected on his platform of reforming the village maintenance programs, but the businesses running them weren't cooperative and threatened to drop their support for him if he did those things. Ultimately, he dropped it altogether. His main focus now is the larger elephant in the room, the downward spiral that is their economy. Many residents of this village are either young families letting their kids play outside all day, or old recluses locking themselves away, turning their homes into coffins. One such coffin had just seen the body removed. Natural causes, though no one was willing to buy it just yet. As such, it made for a perfect get-together spot for a certain couple of people. Maxwell knocked on the door. It swung open.
"You, Maxwell Clark."
"Clerk, actually."
"Come on in."
The dinge in the air of the house, or what was called a house, was overpowering to Maxwell and seemed to even dim the lighting used. Though, realistically, it was because the bulbs were on the verge of burning out and the lamps were all poorly crafted cheap fixtures. Several people were inside, more perhaps upstairs or outside even.
"Come to the basement."
The man's voice was gravelly, which put Maxwell into a state of fight or flight. This could be some sort of elaborate trap, but Maxwell knew there shouldn't be anyone after him. His mind was racing as he thought it best not to make the people here feel like he might be wishy-washy.
"Glad to meet you. We saw your flyer at just the right time."
When he stopped talking, he made sure Maxwell was behind him and focused hard. He clapped his hands together and then spread them apart. As he did so, the empty basement was filled with a quickly expanding room that just barely fit inside. This new room within the room was filled with slot machines and chairs and activities of all kinds. Luckily, the basement was large enough, though Maxwell suspected that his ability might be variable depending on the size of the area he uses it.
"I'm Tolver. I hear you are good with electronics."
"My specialty."
"Good."
Maxwell followed Tolver over to a machine.
"These things break all the time, so if you don't mind, I'd like to have you fix them for me."
All that work. The walk from the dock through Fisher's Paradise, pasting posters up as he went. The talking to person after person, many of which having no patience to offer anyone a job, taking in the city as he diverted his attention to more flyers being set up, and finally he gets a call. And it happens to be exactly the type of work he was looking for. Maxwell was thankful. He knew exactly who these people were, and he didn't care. Now he could work his magic and get paid.
The quicker you work, the better. Okay?
Sure thing.
Alexander wasn't sure how to finish his goal, how to find what he was looking for. The restaurant was very near. Within minutes, he'd reunite with Lahara and Dahlia. Now he'd get a chance to give them their dresses he made. It was a simple matter for him. He doubted if Needles had warmed up to the two girls yet. Needles seemed apprehensive about Dahlia, which put Alexander on edge.
There's some other Nen users in there.
Needles was giving a warning to Alexander, but he wasn't sure how to take it. He already knew of Dahlia and Lahara. If he could get a chance to see the others there, it might be helpful in the long run. However, if he walks in and it turns out to be a trap, he would have wasted Needles's warning. They entered. Candy watched as they walked in and headed over to the table Lahara and Dahlia were sitting at. Lahara seemed very cheery to see him. Whisk was just trying to make sure he kept eating and petting Shen. The food was something he hadn't remembered ever tasting before. It was a new memory to him. Candy made a notice that Whisk shared with Shen.
Alexander, how has your day been?
Dahlia was still quiet while Alexander answered.
It's been nice. I met some interesting people. This city's full of all sorts.
Dahlia looked around when he said that. She thought he said that to particularly include the people at the other table drawing their attention. While this was happening, Needles had wandered to take a look at what he felt like was another presence. Shen also did the same, without moving. They were both invisible to the people in the room, and yet managed to get a vague idea of the location of each other through other senses.
So, did you finish those dresses?
You could hear the excitement in Lahara's voice.
As a matter of fact, I did. I can bring you up to the room and show you right now if you'd like.
I'd love that.
Just then, Dahlia had a thought like he could have been a rapist this whole time, playing them for this moment. The thought had entered and immediately involved to a fight for life and how she'd probably become a corpse there in that moment as a manipulative man coaxed her into a room for nefarious purposes. When a horrible thought enters your mind, oftentimes there will be a shock reaction, a subconscious twitch that might be subtle enough to pass by without detection unless you were looking for it. Needles noticed it. He wouldn't be able to say for sure what it meant, but he could pass it along to Alexander. Needles's movements were undetected by most, except for Shen. An invisible war had taken place in the restaurant, and Whisk never stopped eating.
So, Candy, what else did he tell you?
They're staying in this abandoned building. He couldn't tell who or how many people they had, but he assumed it was more than six, based on the amount of people he saw. A group like that shouldn't be too common around here.
Are we going there next?
I think so. We might as well be forward with them. Or at least see why no one else was able to get a hold of them.
I don't think other people have a guy like Lai Bin, with a network of people giving him information, though.
True, but if we can just go up to them and see for ourselves what their deal is, we can go about finding that Han Cronus guy.
Did the pawn shop guy say where to find him?
He said he's been going from bar to bar, getting in fights and passing out. Telling him we found his friend might be even more difficult than actually finding the others.
Should we ask him about it?
Apparently that's what makes him start fights. Whenever someone asks him a question about the whole matter, I guess everything he knew was in his plea.
Guess we'll do that last then.
He rubbed Shen's head.
Although, maybe we could tell him that we know where his friend is, and then take him with us to double check.
It's up to you, Candy. I'm good either way.
Lahara, Dahlia, and Alexander were leaving the eatery. Outside, the smelly athlete that Lahara passed by in the morning ran by. He seemed to be in a hurry. The group made their way up to Alexander's room. Inside was a scene of curtain parts strewn about. It was clear he acclimated the materials of whatever he could find around him from his environment. The fee for the damages would wind up being a fortune, they imagined. He did not care. Needles was watching the two of them as Alexander went for the dresses he had hanging up. Alexander came out with two dresses. He handed one to Dahlia. It was a deep purple with silky edging, pink hues accenting the shape. She could tell by looking at it that it would fit better than anything else she owned. Still, Alexander felt like he could do better. Dahlia didn't know how to respond to a gift.
I'd recommend adjusting the sleeves,
he said as she was feeling the textures on it. He took her awestruck silence as a compliment and moved to Lahara. He handed her a dress that was white with iridescent blue and gold bust and shoulders, The white had blue tints over itself, and the colors created a flow that was elegant and accented the length of the dress well. Both dresses were simple in overall design, with complexity hidden in every subtlety. They were pieces of art. Before he had a chance to recommend any more changes, she spoke.
Don't say a word. It's perfect. I don't want to know how it might be changed because this, as it is perfect.
Alexander just smiled. Needles was looking out the window, trying to see any sign of something going on down there. He gave up on worrying about Dahlia when he saw her face as she took in the sight of the dress. She was just a kid, after all, in his eyes.
What are you two going to do today?
Well?
Lahara thought, as she had no idea what Dahlia wanted.
I was thinking of going down to the Chamber of Commerce for something.
This caught Alexander by surprise.
Really? I was actually going to go to the town hall and see if I could look at the records for something. Maybe we could go together.
I think that would be great. Dahlia, are you coming too?
Dahlia was on the spot. Her eyes, till then, hadn't left the dress. In her mind, all she could think was how she didn't belong with them. They had all this happiness and this ability to live their life. She often looked at Lahara with envy of how she could be so in control of her life. She wondered how long it would take to ruin their day with her intrusive thinking taking the life away from the moment. Alexander was someone of established talent and a clear goal, it seemed. Dahlia was still looking for the way to make her mark, to live her life. If she stayed with them, she figured her life would become the reverse of the light they were emitting. She'd be their shadow and a dark spot on their promising paths. She needed to establish herself as a person.
Actually, I was going to go to the forest today.
Oh.
Lahara seemed saddened.
We'll meet back at the restaurant for each meal, and we can still go out at nights and wear those dresses.
She enjoyed the time spent with Dahlia, and the meals were the highlights of her time on the island so far. Those and the dress, of course. Dahlia smiled.
Okay.
She said with determination.
Maybe with these two, I could develop even more than I could on my own.
She thought. If she didn't try to strike at some form of independence now, then she might regret it later, which would only hold back Lahara and Alexander. She had to do it, for the growth as a person. It may have been selfish, but she felt that without doing it, she'd be holding them back. So to say there was no sense of altruism behind the act would be incorrect. Lahara and Dahlia put their dresses in their respective rooms and then met with Alexander in the lobby to leave. As they left the hotel, Whisk and Candy left the restaurant with Shen still invisible.
We'll make this officer disappear for you.
Law didn't like what Virgil was saying.
No. Send him off. No disappearing acts.
Fine. I'll command him out into the northern village. No one should care if they see him there.
Good.
Law, you sure about this?
The man behind Law was questioning Law's judgment.
Yes.
Join you for what?
Anya wanted to get to the point.
You heard of Shivra Niarl?
Virgil took the response.
Maybe. What do you have to say about him?
I have something to settle with him.
The other man chimed in again.
He's too strong for any one person, though.
Virgil liked the sound of that. Anya also liked the sound of Law's statement. Law seemed powerful, and yet this Shivra person had him seeking help. If she would ally with him, she might see a powerful person like him succumb to fear, which would be very useful for her toolbox. However, if Virgil would cross him, she'd still like to see Virgil fall to fear as well. In fact, it was now more personal for her to desire seeing Virgil in fear. If she could manage both, that could also be an option. The consequences were tough to see in this now swirling, warping island, whose hope was transforming into something of a transposition of terror.
Good work, Maxwell.
Thank you. It's what I'm here for.
Well, I want to let you know, there's more work to be had with us. One of our guys hasn't come back in a bit.
He said this with a tone that implied he knew where he was.
So it would be nice to have another set of hands on board, especially hands with skill.
Tulva was probing Maxwell for hesitance. Maxwell showed only excitement. However, he was also aware of where this group was headed. It took a strong mind to keep only his excitement showing, and not his suspicions. If he was to keep his job, he'd need to walk a line. For now, he was realizing just what this city was doing, undulating with sickness. Regardless, he had found a job, and keeping it was his next priority.